There we go. Okay, ready to go. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the December 4th meeting of the Portland City Council. Would you please call the roll, Sue?
Novick.
Here.
Fritz.
Here.
Fish.
Here.
Saltzman. Hales.
Here. Good morning, everyone. Let's start with communication. Oh, sorry. Let's start with a proclamation. We have one. Is Jean here? Jean Blackburn? There she is. Hi. Good morning, Jean. How are you? Jean is here on behalf of a great cause for this particular season. Let me read this proclamation and ask you to come up and say a few words about this program, if you will. Whereas volunteers of Be a Santa to a Senior intend to positively affect the city of Portland and surrounding communities by providing holiday cheer and gift giving to senior adults who are least likely to receive presents during the holiday season and who are socially isolated, lonely, or financially challenged. And whereas Be a Santa to a Senior and its volunteers seek to eliminate the holiday isolation felt by our senior adults. And whereas Home Instead Senior Care and Be a Santa to a Senior partners share a belief that our senior adults should not be alone or forgotten during the holidays, as they have been instrumental in defining our communities. And whereas Be a Santa to a Senior participants intend to recognize and celebrate our senior adults and the invaluable contributions they make to our communities. And whereas the citizens of Portland recognize that our diverse population is committed to improving the peace and well-being for our community and wish to focus on our lonely elders through the Be a Santa to a Senior program. And whereas the City of Portland will join together to reinvest in our elders and provide warm smiles, holiday cheer, and gifts through Be a Santa to a Senior, now, therefore, I, Charlie Hales, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim the month of December as Be a Santa to a Senior month in Portland and encourage all citizens to participate. Welcome. Good morning.
Morning, Mayor Hales. Thank you. And commissioners, my name is Mike Brandt. I employ Jean, and I'm the franchise owner with Home Instead Senior Care in the area. And I understand I have
Take a few minutes and tell us about this program, please.
Okay, thank you. Home Instead Senior Care is a provider of in-home care services to elderly people in our community. We have caregivers who go to where the seniors live. Sometimes the seniors are still living in their own homes. Sometimes they're in retirement communities or assisted living, sometimes living with their adult children. And we help with cooking, cleaning, driving the seniors to their appointments, personal care hands-on help with bathing, dressing, grooming. We have a specialty with dementia care, Alzheimer's disease, and other dementias. That's the background of the company, and the service we provide is primarily a private pay service. And so in the holiday season, we really make an effort in our community service to reach out to those who may not be able to afford this type of service and partner with nonprofit organizations in the community. This year and in past years, we're partnering with the Meals on Wheels people. Mm. To deliver the gifts. And essentially, the Be a Santa to a Senior program is a holiday gift-giving program where we partner with the nonprofit organizations and local retailers to, and it's not an original idea, but we do a good job in executing the idea, which is community members can come into a location where there's either a Christmas tree or a wreath with a cardstock ornament on it, and the ornament has written on it the name of a senior in need and a gift idea, maybe what they would want for Christmas. And the need is great. We're serving low-income seniors usually, so they're asking for things like new bath towels, stationery, and stamps so they can correspond with their loved ones. In the cold season, which we can all relate with today, the scarves, mittens, hats, things to keep them warm in their dwellings, which are sometimes low on heat because they're worried about cost. Instead, Senior Care has found this is the eighth year that this program has been running, and as a company, Home Instead Senior Care is a franchise system. So we have locations all around North America and even in other countries. But this is my sixth year of doing the program, and there's also an east side location for Home Instead that's doing the program. Mm-hmm. I'm on the west side. And together we're providing we're going to reach 550 needy seniors who would probably experience low companionship or maybe isolated, being low mobility, sensory deficits, small social circles. Their family members maybe have passed away, their spouse maybe passed away. People who don't get out a lot, they're not getting out to see the lights and the musical performances and the wonderful things of the holiday season. And also, maybe they might not even have someone to come visit them, or maybe they might not even get a gift. A Christmas season, you know, holiday season goes by without being acknowledged with a gift somehow. So Home and State Senior Care recognized that problem and are working to solve it. The gifts are collected at the tree locations, and we involve community members, too, for wrapping the gifts, and the delivery is done through the Meals on Wheels people, and that's, you know, how we're kind of tying ourselves into nonprofits and being of service to those that we typically wouldn't be able to reach with our privately paid caregiving services that we provide.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So is there a website for the program as well?
There is. It's called BeASantaToASenior.com.
Okay.
And that is where if you put in your zip code, you'll find the nearest tree location to you. And in the Portland metro area, we have, I think, 12 places where people could go to find one of these cardstock ornaments. And usually at retailers on the east side, we've got Fred Meyer's, some coffee shops, some banks. On the west side, we have pharmacy, gift shop, and you know, a Bi-Mart, and all the way out in Forest Grove, we reach to. So, you know, to make a difference for 550 seniors in one holiday season, I think is a worthy contribution. And each year it grows, and next year we'll do more. It's one of those programs that has kind of a name brand to it. Now that it's been going on enough, the media outlets recognize it, you know, from across the country. And we're just honored that we can be recognized by the city and have this proclamation put forth. So, you know, raise the awareness of the program in another way and help people know how they can be involved to make a difference for a senior who can be isolated or homebound or not receiving a gift at Christmas time.
Well, thanks so much for being here today, and Gene, you as well. We appreciate these kinds of gestures from the community, from business, from nonprofits, some longstanding ones, of course, like Meals on Wheels. They do great work every day, so I think it was great that you teamed up with them to get these gifts out to folks. That's a nice combination. So,
absolutely.
Thank you. Let's hear it for this great program.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Can we take a photo with you before you go? Come on up with the council, if you would, please. Thank you very much. Okay, let's move on to communications items with 1141.
1141, request of Steve House to address council regarding Powell Butte Nature Park Trail Improvement Project.
House, you here? There he is. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Steve House. Previously, I complained to council that the city is in breach of contract with the public and has failed to comply with the permit requirements for the Powell Butte Trail Improvement Project. Subsequently, the Water Bureau did respond to my complaints and I believe essentially admitted to these allegations. During the public process, Water Bureau committed to the city trail guide. It's a commitment of public record. The trail guide is a safety standard. It contains objective trail design criteria. BDS issued a permit and cited user safety on the trail guide as justification for project approval. Since, therefore, it's a requirement. Unfortunately, the trail improvement project does not comply with the trail guide specifications, and Water Bureau indicated they never intended to comply from what I see. So in my mind, you know, it's kind of a bait and switch on the public. Many of the trails, Water Bureau simply removed user restrictions and designated these trails as multi-user trails without bringing trails into compliance with the safety specification. Additionally, they built new trails that do not comply with the safety specs. In fact, they built trails that are almost the exact opposite of their stated commitments and the permit requirements. These trails are unsafe due to noncompliance. They exhibit unsustainable high erosion rates, are extremely dusty during peak summer usage. The trail guide states that hikers should be able to enjoy the park trails without worrying about their safety due to high-speed downhilling bikes on steep, narrow trails with limited sight lines. Another noncompliance is that the new Pioneer Orchard Loop does not comply with the specs for maintenance and fire roads. It's already been damaged by trucks and is essentially unusable by fire trucks in case there was a major forest fire at Powell Butte. I've been bringing these complaints to the city for 18 months, and it just seems like the city's proven incapable of fixing these and other problems. At this stage, it seems like the Water Bureau and Parks are now blaming each other, which I think is sort of is fairly dysfunctional. And since the Water Bureau and Parks have been unable to bring the project into compliance with its requirements, I'm asking the mayor's office to hire an outside contractor who has expertise. And a good first step would be to survey the trails and post user signs at all intersections in order to achieve some compliance. Powell Butte is a 600-acre nature park with 14 miles of trails. So the lack of trail user signs is a safety issue and noncompliance in itself. Also, I would request a full project review for compliance by with other issues with the public commitments and project permit.
Mayor, if I could just
please
say,
thanks.
First of all, Mr. Howes, thank you for coming in and testifying. We made a commitment, I think about 6 months ago, to take a fresh look at all of Mr. Howes' concerns. And frankly, there's hundreds of pages of documents. And I believe recently I shared with all my colleagues the most recent responses. And I've been overseeing those to make sure that there's a timely response and a complete response. And I appreciate Mr. Howes' view. I all we can do is give answers and provide documents. We can't apparently satisfy him on almost anything he's raised, but you now have all the documents. So if any of my colleagues believe that there's something further we can do, I'm all ears. I believe we reached the limit of what we can do. And in our system, we answer questions, we provide documents. It doesn't necessarily mean we always convince people. And Mr. Howes, you have sent almost an email a week for years. You have submitted all kinds of requests. You have apparently a deep-seated passion for this issue, and I thank you for that. But I just want you to know,
Excuse me, sir.
So there's no misimpression.
You don't have personal knowledge of this,
I do.
And your people said that
I do. Please don't interrupt me.
Let me finish, Mr. Howes.
There's been timely responses. We are taking people out of other responsibilities to get you responses to voluminous requests.
I've got one response.
This is not the time and the place, Mr. Howes, but I want my colleagues.
You need to speak the truth.
Let him finish.
I want my
please.
Colleagues to know that if they, in reviewing the record, have concerns, please bring those to my attention or to Amanda's attention, and we'll take a fresh look. There are limits to what we can do, and I would say in defense of our bureaus, they've been very responsive, and that doesn't necessarily mean that Mr. Howes
not
is convinced.
True.
But they've fulfilled their responsibility. If there's something we've missed, I will look fresh at it.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you bringing this to the council's attention.
Nothing he said is true.
Well, let's not debate now, but I appreciate you bringing it to our attention. And,
yes.
And he's gotten the documents.
I guess I'll have to hire a lawyer and sue the city just to get you people to comply with your own laws, your own contract.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
sir. These guys are, that is the biggest bunch of lies.
Okay.
In your response, you admitted you're in noncompliance. You said we never intended to comply with the city's trail guide. Nobody has ever met with me personally. I've sent these
Mr.
emails
Howes,
in.
You need to
And the people
stand
that did talk to me say, we don't know anything about trail design.
Mr. Howes, you brought it to our attention. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, next item, please.
Item 1142, request of Crystal Olinsky to address council regarding previous communications topic.
Crystal, are you here this morning? Okay, not yet. All right, go ahead, please. 1143.
1143, request of Joe Rossi and Amelia Salvador to address council regarding the 2013 Portland Immigrant Person of the Year Award, and they cannot make it. They express their regrets.
All right, and 1144.
1144, request of Ed Hernandez to address council regarding Preserve Gateway Area Business and Employment.
Hernandez? we're not doing well this morning. Okay, 1145, please.
Request of David Red Thunder to address council regarding West Hayden Island.
Okay, David, are you here? Come on up. Good morning.
Good morning.
Please, just to Sue, that's fine. Thanks. Morning.
Morning. Thank you for this opportunity, Mayor and the panel. I've lived at Hayden Island for 5 years now, and the reason why I got involved is because the Port of Portland said that it was a barren land and the eagle's nest was 2 miles away. Well, if there's an eagle on the land, it doesn't seem like it's barren. So as I started walking back there, I seen that there's over 30 black-tailed deer, the state bird, the western meadowlark also is roaming around there. And so as I followed 30 hours a year listening to the city, the commissioners over there, I heard about the jobs and about how important and all the money spent, but also there's a treaty book in 1855, which Hayden Island was the usual and accustomed place for hunting. And today I see all the abundance of animals back there, and I realize that, you know, today it's still the same. It's hunting. Well, the eagles every year takes, let's say, hunters, they come, it's legal to hunt on Hayden Island. For the state line washes up on the shoreline of the port's property, and it goes from 3 to 20 feet, and that brings the hunters there. They sit in front of the grain barge, and they shoot the geese that come there to feed, and that's 665 feet away from the eagle's nest. And so that was confirmed by Christopher Allori, who is a sergeant of the Rangers, and there's 5 of them in the state of Oregon. So legally, the hunters come and shoot the deer and shoot the geese, and I just think that that's a violation. And so just a minute here, I gotta get, okay. A foundation is being poured. I believe a development is being development is now happening right now because of the spoils. It says right here in the DEQ,
Mr. Thunder, the development is starting where?
On Hayden Island. Foundation is being poured. It says right here, it says that the port will use the sediment as fill material for future and commercial industrial development at the West Hayden Island placement site, which to me is a development is going on right now as we speak. And so when Bob Salinger asked, what happens if this terminal isn't built here, what are we going to do with all the spoils that are set on the island? And so far, Tim Spencer, this has been out, the ammonia level has been out of whack, which means the ammonia didn't turn back into nitrates. And so they covered that up, which is a contamination. And so, anyways, I'll let.
Well, you're out of time, but you've given us this material. We'll review it. Let me say, I think you raised some valid issues here, but I believe the situation is that even though the land is now not yet annexed to the city of Portland, that's what the Planning Commission was considering and what the council's not yet reviewed. So far, the land is still outside of the city limits of Portland. But even in that condition, the port can seek state approval to put dredge material on part of the island, and that's what they're doing. So that doesn't inevitably lead to development. In other words, just because they're putting dredge material on the island, which they get to do in a number of places up and down the Columbia River, under state authority, that doesn't mean that the city of Portland has approved any kind of development there. We have not, and no development is possible there while the land is outside of the city limits as it is today. So it might look like the first stage of development, and the port might even think of it as the first stage of development, but legally they can't pour a foundation and build a building or build a dock or build anything else until this council has taken action, and we haven't yet.
Mayor, so can I just ask one
additional question? You have that safeguard for actual development. Doesn't mean they can't put sand, dredge spoil sand, on the island. They're doing that. They have been doing that for years, but that doesn't inevitably lead to development.
Thank you, Mayor. Commissioner Ball came to the island, and he said that they would put the Indians and all the discussions, and it came up on the board, but there was no actually discussion about the nation and all the money they put into it. And now he said they handle that in phases. Well, it went from the commissioners down there, and now it's to your table. Right. And I've seen that the first thing they did is they put this resolution of 38, Eric, and now I'd like this resolution of 369-41 to be discussed, because it discusses how much money the tribe has put into there and how valuable, because it actually is the Columbia River is designated critical habitat for 13 different species that go to and from the ocean. And it says that the Hayden Island is the last stop because the tidal actions, the fish actually use this tidal action before they get on the Willamette River and head to the ocean. Right. And I look up and down to the west, the Washington side of it, and I see that there is no sandy beaches that they can have. So Hayden Island is a custom unusual place and one of the last places along the Columbia River that these salmonoids have chance to continue on. And so I just like to let you know that there's I see this. And every time the ship is turned around, I see that this cross current sends these little salmonoids up on the beach and to where I've called the Oregon State Fish and Game, and they said, yes, it's from the turning of the ships that cross currents, and they send these little salmonoids up onto the beach. And so
Mayor, since you and I are working together on the Superfund issue, right. I just want to summarize what I see from these documents you've given us, sir. One is you're raising a question about the dredging and the placement of those materials on the island.
Yes.
Two is you're raising some questions about the whole process of considering annexation of West Hayden Island, so that's very timely.
Yes.
And third, most of the documents you've given us have to do with what you call tribal interests, and are we dealing with tribal government partners and observing treaties? And those are very important issues, and thanks for giving us this with the various sections, and I can assure you that as these discussions go forward, that is an important part of our consideration, is engaging our tribal partners. So if we fall short on that, you'll let us know.
It's just more on the board. When it's put up on the board, to hear people actually talk about what their nation has done, you know, because it made it onto the board, but it's like, we've got the state bird back there mixed in with all the pipes, the dredge pipes. Every time you ride the bike through there, the eagle's nest is overlooking. I mean, either or, it's either have to destroy this nest or we preserve this nest, because it's right in the middle of this project, this terminal project. Mm-hmm. And so anyways, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you bringing this to us. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, did either Ed or Crystal make it here this morning? Okay. Then if not, let's take the consent calendar. I think we have four items that have been requested to be pulled, 1151, 1149, 1154, and 1156, right?
Can you say those again, Mayor?
1149, 1151, 1154, and 1156. Any others? Any other requests? Okay. So then let's take a vote, please, on the balance of the consent calendar.
Novick.
Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Fish.
Aye.
Hales.
Aye. Okay, now let's move to time certain, 1146.
1146, amend the fiscal year 2013-14 budget to include appropriations for funds to address human trafficking.
Mr. Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor Hales, and thanks to the Council for your partnership on this important issue. As we know, we struggled greatly during our budget discussions to meet the constraints that we were faced with, and we did an amazing job on that. As part of that discussion, we had a lot of testimony about services for survivors of human trafficking, and we were not able to meet all of the needs as part of the budget process, so I'm bringing back this supplementary package asking for a total of $250,000 from contingency to fund these vital services. Since the budget process, U.S. Attorney Amanda Marshall and Portland State University put out another study that showed the extent of the challenge in our community, and it's an urgent need that particularly young people and young adults ages 18 to 25 are not able to access the services that they need to escape from this terrible slavery, I think it is, there's no other way to describe it. And so I'd like to call Andrew Scott, the budget director, just to explain the mechanics of what we're doing here. He and Christine Moody have been very helpful in guiding me on just how we do this. Sometimes we would have put this in the budget monitoring process, which we did a few weeks ago. This is so important that after discussion with the mayor, we decided to bring it separately. But Andrew can tell us specifically. And what we're doing this week is allocating the funds, and then before the end of the year, we'll be bringing back contracts for the particular projects to be funded. Thank you for being here.
Yes, good morning. Andrew Scott, I'm City Budget Director. I'll be very brief. What the ordinance does in front of you, it amends the 13-14 budget to include the appropriations that Commissioner Fritz is referring to. Specifically, in the Council Directs section, what it does is it moves $190,000 out of general fund contingency into special appropriations. It moves $60,000 out of general fund contingency into the Police Bureau budget. And then again, it shows that $250,000 total reduction from that general fund unrestricted contingency. And again, the exhibits in the ordinance talk a little bit about where the funds are going to go. And I think, Commissioner, you're going to have some other folks come up and talk about the specifics of that. Contingency currently, after the fall bump, sits at $753,000, almost $754,000. So this reduction would take it down to just over $500,000. General, it would be at $503,791 after this action.
Okay, great. Thank you, Andrew.
The other thing I will just note, and it's just very briefly, in terms of the $190,000 in the special appropriation, $70,000 of that I think would also be for the NOW program, which is actually run by the Police Bureau. So we will probably spend the money directly out of special appropriations, although we may need to make a technical adjustment later in the year to move it in. It shouldn't impact council at all, but just so you know that that $70,000 of that funding will be spent through that program managed by the Police Bureau.
Okay, good. Thank you.
And again, thanks to Andrew Scott from the Budget Office and Christine Moody, the Chief Procurement Officer, who's been guiding me through this. Thank you. So just to frame how we came to this number and the proposed projects, although the projects will be discussed in more detail or be actually allocated in a couple of weeks or so, I pulled together a task group of providers, survivors, and Commissioner Diane McKeel from the county, Jocelyn Baker, who works with the county, to just discuss what are the most urgent needs and what are the things that we can get done in the next 6 months. This is not ongoing funding. This is a one-time allocation, and it's to do the things that are the most urgent to do from January to June of 2014. So we came up with the three main project areas that are being proposed, and I invite Dennis Morrow from Janus Youth, Lena Sinha, and Christine Lum from New Options for Women and the Sexual Assault Resource Center to come and describe a little bit the projects that we're proposing. Thank you for being here today, and thank you for your work on this important project.
Okay. Good morning. Thank you all for the opportunity to be here today. That's going to be pretty loud for me. And I want to thank you, Amanda, specifically for making this presentation possible. We know that the girls and young women that we work with in the projects that you're considering lack two crucial things in their lives. One is knowing that someone really does care about them, and the other is a role model for what they could be, who they could become as a strong, powerful woman when they believe in themselves. Your commitment, your determination, and your leadership for them over the last several months, and particularly on this issue, is a very concrete example in a way that we professionals can never provide. So thank you for that and for them. Approximately 4 years ago, I came before you to support a commitment which this council was about to make to provide funding for child victims of sex trafficking, funding to open the first and still the only shelter in the state for these children, and the first and still the only team of SARC volunteers and advocates to support them through their recovery and healing process. This funding was a bold statement by city leaders at the time to combat the face that Portland had become known as nationally, which was Pornland, and to beat back our growing reputation as a national hub for the sale of children for sex. I am proud to say that the money that you gave us was well invested. Literally hundreds of girls, as well as some boys, have benefited. Half of them have been under age 15, two-thirds of them come from racial or cultural minority groups, and over 90% live within the city boundaries that we are talking about today. When I talked with one of our youth at Athena House a couple weeks ago, who was hoping to graduate and become a counselor herself someday, I said to her, what does it take to get you out of this life? What kind of support do you need? And she said, two things, Dennis. One is I need a safe place like Athena House that I can go to and keep coming back to when I run away, because I will. And secondly, I need somebody I can talk to any time of the day or night about anything and know it's safe, and that's my SARC advocate. And with those two pieces, it gives me a route out of the streets. Our services and our system of services in Multnomah County has developed into a national model, but we're still learning daily what it takes to reach these kids and to help them find a way back home. Now we've reached a new milestone. After 5 years of working with younger girls, they've grown up. SARC estimates that half of its caseload is now aging out of our current system of services by turning over 18. These, as you know, and I know, being 18 or 19 does not make them any less of a child. They still face the same risk, the same dangers that they had before they turned 18, and they still have the same basic needs, a safe place to stay, a safe place to come back to, and a caring adult who is there for them. That's what this package of services begins to make available. The funding that would come to Janus Youth Programs, where I work, will specifically be used to provide access for girls and, if necessary, boys who are over age 18 to both emergency shelter and a long-term situation or home where they can live as long as they need it. We're in the process right now of redesigning our entire shelter program based on what the youth have taught us and what our partners like SARC and DHS need from us to provide services for these kids. The expanded age range will become a part of this process. Funding will help us add staff. Those staff will allow the expanded age range. They will also allow us to deepen the level of services that we're providing now for the kids, because that's one of the things that we have seen is missing for them. I'm also here today to ask that if you commit to this money, that you each make a personal commitment to work collaboratively with Multnomah County to ensure an ongoing investment to sustain core services for this population. You can define what those core services are, but some programs, some populations do work on a temporary or trial basis. Those ones that we're bringing forward today may be some of those. But the truth is that core services for child victims of child sex trafficking can never, ever again be left in doubt if this community truly cares. Or we will just become the next set of adults who failed them and the next generation of parents to deprive them of their childhood. I am not saying that city money must continue, because I know that's part of the active debate, but I'm saying that the city funding and the government and the county funding, that somehow the governments have to get together and figure out how to provide ongoing sustainable support for these children. I teach classes for Multnomah County for parents going through divorce, and the first thing I tell them when they walk into the class is that what we found out over 40 years of looking at history of divorce is that somebody has to grow up and be the adult. And what I'm asking as part of this commitment is that we all grow up and be the adults and sit down together and figure out not how we just do what we're doing today, but how we maintain ongoing services that are needed between the two governments for the future. I want to thank each of you for your concern. I want to thank each of you for your caring. I know all of you deeply take this issue personally and for your personal commitment, and I want to thank you for that commitment now, and I want to thank you for that ongoing commitment as we move ahead with this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dennis. And I should have mentioned in my framing that, yes, indeed, the city and the county are committed to looking at funding for a wide range of services. The county has been doing some briefings for us on mental health services, and I think this is another piece where looking at what the county puts in and what we put in, there's obviously still a huge gap. So thank you for mentioning.
Yeah, thank you. And I apologize, but I do have to.
Oh, then before you go, just some questions there, if I can. One, can you summarize what the city is, what the county is doing at this point?
What the county's doing, in terms of the shelter, the county funds the shelter. It was a joint city-county funded project. $70,000 was removed, so the city funds a case manager for us at the shelter. The county puts about $350,000 into the shelter. The city funds two SARC advocates currently. The county funds another two SARC advocates currently. So the county and the county money went this year in the budget from one-time money, which it had been for the last several years, into an ongoing funding category. So it's now part of their core budget and service elements. And they actually have a planning process working with a group of us as well to look at add-ons to that system for the next budget year. So they're planning on increasing their level of commitment investment to this over the next year.
Yeah, I just wanted to key off your point about the city and the county working together. Chair Madrigal and I are going to make sure that our two budgets are proposed coherently, because frankly, even for really great programs like this, our budgets are incoherent at this point in the way you just described. I mean, I don't think from any management standpoint, the scheme that you just described is something anyone would recommend.
I agree with that.
And we tore into that question a little bit in the last budget, but we're tearing into it a lot more now. And again, it's just the question of the adults are in the room. We do have, you know, elected officials on both boards that are ready to work together and take up the questions of who should do what and who manages it and who provides oversight, because I don't think we're there yet on a lot of issues, whether it's homelessness or mental health or these issues of trafficking. So I think you'll see us, particularly Chair Madrigal and I, because the budget mm-hmm. process will be under our leadership in each
right.
case until such time as there's a new chair later this summer or next summer. Second question I had for you is, my impression from dealing with the Police Bureau lately is that they are being quite aggressive in dealing with Johns and being more sensitive in dealing with victims. Is that your impression as well? What other recommendations do you have for us and for me as the police commissioner about the direction and approach that the Police Bureau is taking to trafficking?
I'm going to let the SARC folks and the NOW folks answer that, because they work more directly on a day-to-day basis.
Okay,
we're sort of like the emergency room where the ambulance pulls up to.
Yeah. Okay.
What I will tell you is the officers that I have worked with in the planning on this are deeply committed to it. And I will tell you that the change in the law the state made gives us leverage that we have not had before to really, I think, for the first time, go at the demand side of it. And my hope is some of this money is also for some prevention work in the schools, but what we need to now do is prevention work on the streets with the guys that are purchasing the sex. And with this new law, for the first time, we have a tool we can do that. And that's my hope, is the police can exercise some continuing leadership in helping us get public now what the actual penalties are for that.
Yeah, okay, good. And I'll be interested in hearing your comments as well. But my impression so far in dealing with the Police Bureau on this issue is that they're very serious about applying that new authority in just the way that we all would have hoped,
mm-hmm.
and focusing on the purchasers rather than on the victims.
Yes, and the prosecutors are in the same place with this. So I think there's some real unity all the way around.
Okay, good. Thank you.
All right, thanks very much.
Hi. I'm Lena. I'm from SARC, and I'd like to echo
Jaden. Just remind folks what SARC stands for.
Oh, yeah, the Sexual Assault Resource Center. And I'm the program manager for the CSEC program, which is the Commercially Sexually Exploited Children program at SARC. It's a long-term advocacy program for child victims of human trafficking. So that's who I am. First, thank you for having us here today and for your commitment to this issue. Before I get started about this particular grant, I just want to echo Dennis's gratitude for your funding over the last several years for the SARC case managers. Each one of those case managers sees between 15 and 30 kids every month and is able to provide them support and connection to resources and support through the law enforcement process, through the prosecution process, that they would otherwise not have. And it makes a huge difference. So human trafficking is a increasingly relevant topic across the country. And so I hear a lot of folks across the country that call and say, you guys are doing it right in Portland. What? Tell me how you're making this happen. And the thing that's innovative and that everyone sees as innovative in Portland is that there's a broad scope of collaboration. And this includes the city, the county, and specifically the Police Bureau advocate relationship is extremely unique. It's not happening anywhere else. And it's one of the things that makes this work so well here. So this grant that we're talking about specifically today would really continue to expand that partnership and help us help SARC advocates be on the scene when police come into contact with the youth and make the police, who are traditionally very scary and intimidating to these young men and women, partners give them the ability to transfer them into services. And that's a really that's a really powerful thing to be able to do, is to build that community. Seeing the police as an ally instead of sort of this scary thing. It also gives SARC the opportunity to expand our relationship with drug and alcohol treatment and other resources because, as Dennis said, our population is aging out, and we've now expanded our age range from 18 to 23, and being able to connect them to more resources provides a lot of self-sufficiency for them, and it strengthens the whole system of care. It gives the survivors more options and more ways to operationalize their own goals and become self-sufficient. And that is good because it increases the determinants of health for these young people. It's good for them, it's good for our community, and it's good for the city, who will ultimately be responsible for fewer resources across their lifetime. So I think that's all that I have to say about that. And I wanted to address your – remind me what your question was about the police again.
Describing them as partners, which is good. I like that,
absolutely,
that description, and that is indeed the expectation that I have for them in working with you and working with this now new authority under state law. My impression is that they get it about focusing on the Johns and on the purchasers, not on the victims of trafficking. I'm just looking for field confirmation or concerns that are how close to being there are we in that consciousness in the police bureau, frankly.
I think we're very close to being there, and I think that grants like this expand our services to get there in a broader, wider way, and for a wider age range, which is important.
Good. Thank you.
And also, Officer Gallagher is here to provide testimony directly to that.
Good. Thank you.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Kristen Lum Williams from New Options for Women with LifeWorks.
The whole thing shifts down if you pull it down.
The whole monster,
wooden structure in the middle. You can just slide it down.
Oh, okay.
So there we go.
It's good to see all of you again. Can you hear me okay?
Fine.
So you asked us to speak about what is the problem currently, what New Options for Women will do to address that problem, and what this funding will do. So I'm going to kind of go macro to micro, and then we will have Officer Gallagher speaking directly to that question.
Good.
And I can touch on it too. So originally, New Options for Women was designed to be a response for women who were arrested out on 82nd and Sandy for prostitution. So we had women who were then court-mandated into our program. So over the years, we have adapted and changed to where we have people self-referring themselves. They hear about us on the street. Someone says, hey, I go to this treatment program, you know, and they self-refer. They call us themselves. We have referrals from SARC, Janus, DHS. We have the FBI refers people to us. So we've broadened our referral base from just having court-mandated women. And historically and traditionally, we have women in older, 30s, 40s, 50s, who are in our program. And recently, we've had a shift where we've had a larger number of these youth aging out, these CSEC youth aging out, and they're adults now, and adult services are very different than youth services. So the New Options for Women program is a dual diagnosis mental health and addictions treatment program that also provides case management. So we are designed to provide each woman that comes to our program receives a mental health evaluation, an addictions assessment, and a needs assessment based done by our mentor to assess if they need ID, a birth certificate, social security card, housing, you know, all of insurance, all of these things. So that is what we do. What we are not designed to be is an advocacy program. So we aren't designed to go out with officers like SARC is after hours, weekends, to respond to these calls to these women who are still having those needs after 5 p.m., you know, Monday through Friday. So what we have seen as our program has adapted and changed is that how we can effectively and adequately meet the need of this population has changed and adapted. So this funding will allow us to have a full-time mental health clinician. Currently, we only have a part-time, and that falls under my many hats of things that I do, to directly work with these women as a preventative measure. So these 18 to 25-year-olds who are aging out of services can have support from our community partners into our program to connect them with that addictions treatment and mental health treatment. And some of these needs that is more, not necessarily an advocacy role, but to partner with that advocacy role of connecting to doctor, medical care, dental care, and inpatient addictions treatment, and, you know, to understand and process the trauma that the women we see in our program have endured throughout their life, that mental health treatment that they need to move forward with their life successfully. So as we look back on the program, these women who have been court mandated over the years, who are 30, 40, 50 years old, who have been in the life for 20-something years, this is a preventative measure where we can hopefully rehabilitate these women between the ages of 18 and 25 so that they aren't out on the streets being arrested later on when they're older. So this funding, like I said, it will help us to adequately meet the needs that we currently are facing in our program. I came in September and spoke with all of you, and things are going really well in the NOW program. We're seeing a lot of the younger women are coming to our program, and working with our community partners on this more official basis with this funding will really allow us to effectively step into what their needs are, because adult services are very different than youth services. And a lot of times they get, okay, here's the referral to the New Options for Women program, and they get lost in the shuffle because they aren't used to adult intensive outpatient services. So this funding will really help us be able to effectively do that. So, thank you.
My understanding, in part, the partnership between you two also includes training more volunteers, and particularly culturally specific volunteers, okay, to be that person who can go to court with the person who can help, you know, be the mentor that they call at 3 o'clock in the morning, if that's so they have that ongoing trust relationship with a volunteer. Is that
sure? So SARC does a culturally specific training 4 times a year, and this would allow us to increase that volunteer base and have a wider variety of advocates who can respond 24 hours, who are culturally specific, educated about the trauma, educated about the issue, and can connect them to the appropriate resources.
And if someone wants to volunteer and to get training and be part of that, how would they contact you?
SARCOregon.org, via our website. There's a way to sign up.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank
our
you.
Next panel is for Portland Police Bureau Officer Mike Gallagher and Sarah Johnson and Carolyn Haycraft from the Girls Strength Women program. Part of the discussion, as was just mentioned, as we were looking at solutions, there's often a tendency to look at immediate needs, and of course that's urgent. What we wanted to look at is how do we start getting more serious about prevention, and I was horrified to learn that it's in middle school that both boys and girls become involved in this activity. And so our wonderful Women's Strength, Girl Strength program came up with this proposal to expand their services. They're going to tell you about that now.
I'll go ahead and start then. My name is Sarah Johnson. Good morning, Mayor Hales and commissioners. I'm the director of the Women's Strength program, and currently Women's Strength still pays for one paid employee, who I am here before you, and Carolyn will introduce herself. And what I want to start with is give you a brief history of what our program offerings are for those of you who don't know, and also why we are the right organization to implement this proposal that's put forward. Women's Strength has been offering free or taxpayer-supported holistic self-defense and violence prevention classes for more than 34 years. We have a history of success, and in addition to those specific classes for women, we also offer workshops that are co-ed, that are general personal safety workshops for anywhere and from corporations to shelters. With the two combined offerings for Women's Strength specifically, we've trained more than 100,000 community members in those 34 years. The reason our classes are taxpayer supported is that we have volunteers that teach those classes. Between Women's Strength and Girls Strength, we have 50, what we call them as unpaid employees. In the 34 years of Women's Strength, we've utilized 22,000 volunteer hours, and we have saved the city $442,000. And this is based on a national average of volunteer pay being $18 an hour. So in 2008, Girl Strength was founded based on a need in the community. Women's Strength offers classes for young women and teens, but not for middle schoolers. And so Girl Strength, in its fifth year, has trained more than 4,000 girls, is in 42 schools, including 5 school districts, and on that same number of $18 an hour has saved the city $98,000 in just 5 years. And I also want to talk about, because it's specific to this proposal, that the majority of our offering is to any, all of our offering is open to any woman, young woman of any background and ability, including more than 60% of Girl Strength students being from different backgrounds, ethnicities, and cultures. So, why are we here before you? What we want to talk about is the fact that we are very unique and our volunteers are unique, that all of our volunteers are trained to teach their classes to be safe emotionally and physically for anybody who walks in. So this ties into girls who are survivors, and when we offer a boys program, boys who are both survivors and violence prevention offering. Over 80% of the schools that Girl Strength is taught in have requested a program for boys, and Caroline's going to talk about that a little bit more. We are, the other piece that I feel passionate about, Women's Strength and Girl Strength are secondary prevention programs. We're risk reduction. I'm going to let that sit for a minute because it's extremely important. We want to get into primary prevention. We want to start teaching and prevention skills before the violence begins. So with this proposal, the new Boys Strength Prevention Program would introduce primary prevention to boys and also include male volunteers in our community teaching. With the proposed project, we would hire two part-time employees, their contract employees. They would assist in the development of curriculum, volunteer instructor training, and implementation of a boys program. The goal would be by May of 2014, we would pilot two programs in schools, and by June, we'd have a comprehensive training program for volunteers that would be 120 hours long. On that note, before I turn it over to Caroline, the other goal that's important for you all to know is we want to have a foundation that is sustained, that we can sustain after the funding ends. And so Caroline's going to talk to you a little bit more of the why of this project.
Before we go to Caroline, can I just ask
you
a question?
Absolutely.
So I applaud you for looking at this as a question of going upstream and focusing on prevention.
Thank you.
And that's where we get, we not only get some of our best results, but we save a lot of money because we're ahead of the curve. I'm just curious, when you talk about middle school, which really just, I think, gets all of our attention, what are some of the documented risk factors at the middle school level? Because we're talking about children, and I have someone who's heading into middle school, and it's just shocking to hear that. So I'm just curious, what are some of the...
The stat that pops to mind before we talk about specifically CSEC, which Caroline's going to speak about, when Girl Strength was founded, and I usually don't... I'm a woman and I get nervous about it. I founded Girl Strength in 2008. I will own that. And one of the reasons we chose middle school as the age group is in my research and in research speaking to educators, 80% of middle school girls lose their confidence by the time they reach high school. 75% of boys gain confidence. So we get to high school and we have this inequitable, and it makes sense, unfortunately, that there's a breeding ground for violence and for boundary intrusions. Mm-hmm. So that's the stat that comes to mind. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. And
or part of it.
And so this is for a conversation for another day, but you know, my sense, having raised a daughter, is that precisely that sort of those two trends you identify with boys and girls, one of the ways you get at that is making sure that young girls that want to be involved in sports, for example, have that opportunity, because that's an area where self-esteem is built and role models are coaching and things like that. And
yes.
My guess is there's a whole range of common sense things like that which nurture self-esteem and mitigate against what you're talking about. And at some future time, I'd like to know more about what those are.
Good. And I actually do think I like when things segue. I'm sure you all do. Segue to Caroline, who speak a little more specifically about the program offerings. So
thank you. Thank you, Mayor Hales, for having me here today and commissioners for listening to us. But I'd also like to thank all of our volunteers. And if you could take a moment just to stand up. These volunteers have gone through 128 hours of training to be Girl Strength instructors.
Great.
And we also have teachers and girls are here from schools today to speak with you. As Sarah said, I'd like to address why there is a need for a complementary boys program to prevent violence and specifically CSEC. We know that CSEC, girls are usually the targets, but our main perpetrators of violence, the exploiters, and the Johns are men. Girl Strength has a high success rate in helping girls feel confident and safe. In 2012, we conducted an assessment of Girl Strength's outcomes and effectiveness. We found that approximately 94% of the girls graduating from a 9-week program stated they experienced an increase in confidence and self-esteem. So what this means is that 94% of the girls, 94 out of 100 girls, walked out into the world feeling safe and confident. So how does this relate to CSEC, you're probably wondering? Well, we know pimps target a variety of girls for sexual exploitation, and one of the main characteristics they look for in a girl is low self-esteem. They don't look for girls who are quick to defend themselves and say, "No, leave me alone," to make everyone listen. Girl Strength provides girls with the tools they need to stay safe and make healthy choices. But wouldn't it make sense to provide boys with similar information? When I walk down hallways wearing my Girl Strength t-shirt and holding my kick pad, I encounter boys who say to me, "Why don't you offer a boys program? It's not fair. Don't you think we need self-defense?" Yes, they do need self-defense. And while these boys are thinking about physical skills, an effective boys program would offer a deeper exploration of the roots of violence, especially when we know that males are the main perpetrators of violence. So here's what national research and local research tells us about violence. 1 in 4 girls will be a survivor of sexual assault in her lifetime. 1 in 6 boys are sexually abused, and boys are far more likely to be survivors of physical violence in the playground. 1 in 3 is the ratio. Multnomah County's 2011 Defending Childhood Initiative report states that 4 forms of violence that are most predominant locally are domestic violence, dating violence, bullying, and child abuse. It continues on to say perhaps that the most disturbing finding from this community assessment was the normalization of dating violence and sexual exploitation among local teens. School-based counselors and nurses report that the youth they encounter frequently assume that violence in relationships is both normal and acceptable. This information makes me sad, but it drives me to do the work that I do. Both boys and girls need the information contained in a Girl Strength program. So before I go on, I'd like to share a story with you. 2 years ago, we had a girl that was prevented a sexual assault in her neighborhood by 2 older boys from her school. She told her parents. She used her Girl Strength skills. She broke the code of silence. Her parents decided to take matters into their own hands and not report. The next day, this girl went back to school. The boys were there. They blamed her. They called her a slut and said it was her fault. This girl used her Girl Strength skills again and told the school counselor, who did file a report. What's amazing and sad and in many ways brave about this young girl, and what I'm very proud of, is the detective actually came up and said to us, "That girl said she used her Girl Strength skills to stay safe." I just want to put this out there. This is not a success story. Girl Strength provided the girls with the skills they needed to prevent a sexual assault, but we failed the boys. What if the boys had been in a program that educated them on respecting girls and on differences and boundaries and helped them understand why language choices such as rape face, ho, and bitch are forms of violence demeaning to all women? What if they'd learned how to talk about their feelings and then knew about the importance of healing after any traumatic event? What if they had learned that healthy relationships are based on equality and mutual respect, and that the term boyfriending in human trafficking is a tactic used to recruit girls to sell for sex, not a caring, loving relationship? I leave you to ponder these answers, and I truly appreciate your time.
Thank you. Good morning.
Mayor, commissioners, I'm Mike Gallagher, part of the Portland Police Bureau's prostitution team out of East Precinct. I'm here to address that bridge between SARC and LifeWorks and that transitional group of the 18 to 25-year-old women who are aging out from SARC and hopefully getting into the LifeWorks program. The prostitution team works both street-level and escort investigations involving sex trafficking, targeting the Johns, the women involved in prostitution, and their traffickers, or who what we sometimes refer to as pimps. During these investigations, we routinely encounter a high number of women within the age range of 18 to 25 who are forced to work as prostitutes by their traffickers, who have had traffickers in the past, or who know prostitution is the only way to make money to get by on. This age group is the age group that PCT has the hardest time finding the help and resources needed to get these women out of the lifestyle of prostitution. Having advocates available who know the talk, who know the game, and who know where to get the help available is instrumental in building the trust necessary to get these women into treatment programs and away from sex trafficking. The Sexual Assault Resource Center advocates already have the experience in this area and are well-versed in working with the young women who have been victimized and who are having been worked as prostitutes. LifeWorks New Options for Women program provides the ongoing treatment necessary to get these women out of the lifestyle of prostitution. The SARC and LifeWorks Now program were provided with the means to work cohesively together. SARC advocates and the LifeWorks would be able to bridge the gap that exists between getting these women from their initial police contact into the treatment program of NOW, where they'd be able to get their mental health issues addressed and deal with addiction problems and receive support and services to become productive members of our community. The prostitution team routinely will give these women a break by not arresting them and encourage them to go see LifeWorks. This is often met with distrust because of their distrust of the police bureau and not knowing what the program's about. Having these advocates available 24/7 when we're working, we're out there on the streets or bringing them back to the precinct to talk to them, or maybe contact them the additional day, you know, the day after.